All right, so get ready, because today we're taking a deep dive into, well, you. Human physiology. We're going to be uncovering the secrets behind how your body can keep itself balanced and even transmit signals. You
Yeah.
know, the kind of stuff that literally keeps you going.
It really is incredible.
It is. And the source material we're using today is, well, it's a little intense.
Oh.
Yeah, it's actually some pretty hardcore university physiology course notes. But don't worry, we'll break it down into, well, more manageable pieces.
Sounds good.
So whether you're cramming for like a super important exam or just, fascinated by science, get ready for some serious aha moments. We'll be exploring all sorts of cool things, like how your body just knows what temperature to stay at.
That's always baffled me.
Right. And we'll even figure out how signals can travel, like all the way from your brain to, say, your fingertip. Ready to get started?
Absolutely, let's dive in.
Okay, so let's zoom in way in to the cellular level.
Yeah.
How does my body even know what temperature it's supposed to be?
Ugh, that's where homeostasis comes in. Think of it as your body's way of keeping everything in balance, like a constant, well, a delicate balancing act, no matter what's happening around you.
So even when it's like freezing cold outside, my body is working to stay balanced.
Exactly. You experience homeostasis all the time, like every time you step outside into the cold and you start shivering.
Oh, right. That's my body trying to keep my core temperature stable.
You got it.
But how does that actually work? I mean, are there like little workers in my body constantly making adjustments?
Well, you can think of it like this. Your body has a control system, and that system has three main players: a sensor, an integrator, and an effector.
Okay, I think I'm following so far.
Let's use thermoregulation as an example.
Thermoregulation, that's just a fancy way of saying keeping your body temperature stable, right?
Yeah, exactly. Your body has these special nerve cells that can sense temperature, and they're always monitoring your internal temperature. Those are the sensors. Then there's this area in your brain called the thermoregulation center. You can think of it as the control center or the integrator.
So it's getting all the information from those sensor cells.
Right, and it's comparing that information to your body's set point temperature.
Set point. So that's like a magic number my body's always trying to hit.
It's actually more like a range, a comfortable range, rather than one precise number. You see, your body temperature isn't perfectly constant. It fluctuates a little throughout the day.
Oh, that's interesting.
But homeostasis keeps it within that healthy range. So if your temperature strays too far from the set point, the integrator kicks into gear and sends signals to the effectors.
Yeah, the effectors. Those are the ones that like do something, right? Like they make me sweat or shiver.
You got it. Things like your muscles and blood vessels are effectors. If you're too cold, your muscles shiver to generate heat, and your blood vessels constrict, to conserve warmth.
And if I'm too hot?
If you're too hot, the opposite happens. Your blood vessels dilate to release heat, and you might start sweating to cool down. It's all about these negative feedback loops. Basically, your body counteracts the change to get back to that balance, back to homeostasis.
So it's like a thermostat. It kicks in if things get too far out of whack. But I've also heard of positive feedback loops. Are those part of homeostasis too?
Good catch. They are, although they're much less common. But in certain situations, they're really crucial.
Like when?
Well, childbirth is the classic example of a positive feedback loop.
Oh, right.
As the baby's head starts pushing against the cervix, it sends nerve impulses to the brain, and that triggers the release of oxytocin. And oxytocin makes those uterine contractions even stronger, so it amplifies the whole process until, well, the baby is born.
That is wild. It's like when you get a microphone too close to a speaker, you get that screeching feedback.
Exactly. That's a positive feedback loop in action.
So it's amazing how our bodies can just do all this to keep everything in check. But we've been talking about the body as a whole, and well, what about those individual cells? What role do they play in all of this?
Well, cells are the fundamental unit of life, right? And each cell is surrounded by a membrane. It's way more than just a wall. It's really dynamic and plays a crucial role in maintaining that internal environment we keep talking about. And it even helps with communication between cells. It's kind of like a bustling city, carefully controlling what can go in and out.
Okay, I'm trying to picture a cell as a bustling city.
Well, we call this model the fluid mosaic model.
Catchy.
It's basically a dynamic fluid layer made up of these things called phospholipids.
Phospho what?
Phospholipids. They have a water-loving head and a water-fearing tail. So they arrange themselves in this bilayer. The water-loving heads face outward, and those water-fearing tails, well, they tuck themselves in between.
That's kind of cool.
And right within this bilayer, you have all sorts of proteins embedded, each with its own specific job. Some act like channels, letting certain molecules pass through. Others are receptors binding to signals from other cells. It's really quite complex.
This reminds me of those cell diagrams from like way back in biology class. But this is way more complex. So it's not just a static wall, right? It's dynamic, like it's actively doing things.
Absolutely. And that complexity is, well, it's critical for a cell's survival. Think about cystic fibrosis. It's actually caused by a defect in a specific chloride ion channel, and that messes up the fluid balance in the
So
lungs.
that's why people with cystic fibrosis have that buildup of thick mucus.
Exactly. And then in Alzheimer's disease, you have problems with the membrane structure and function that, well, contribute to the damage of neurons.
Wow, those are some serious conditions. It really highlights how important those tiny structures are for our overall health.
Absolutely. And remember how we were talking about cells working together to maintain homeostasis? Cell-to-cell adhesions are really important for that. They rely on the membrane, too.
I'm trying to remember. Could you refresh my memory on cell-to-cell adhesions?
Sure. So think of the extracellular matrix as a scaffold outside the cells. It provides structural support. Then you have cell adhesion molecules and special junctions that actually hold those cells together, kind of like glue and rivets. And this lets them form tissues and organs, which are essential for the body to function properly.
Right, tissues and organs. So these membranes are involved in, well, pretty much everything. But how do things actually get across those membranes? It can't just be a free-for-all, right?
You're right, it's definitely not. It's all about selective permeability. The membrane is like a very strict gatekeeper, carefully regulating what enters and exits the cell.
Makes sense. But how does the membrane decide what can get through?
Well, several factors come into play. Size definitely matters. Small molecules like oxygen and carbon dioxide, they can slip through the gaps in the phospholipids.
So they're small enough to just like sneak through.
Yeah, exactly. Then you have lipid solubility, which basically means how well a molecule can dissolve in fats. So uncharged, nonpolar molecules like fatty acids, they can pass right through.
Okay, so size and whether it likes fat, what else?
But larger molecules, or those that have a charge like glucose, they need some help.
So it's like a VIP entrance for those molecules.
Exactly. And there are two main ways to get across: passive and active transport. Passive transport is like it's like riding a slide. No energy required. It happens down a concentration gradient. That means things move from an area of high concentration to an area of low concentration.
Oh, like diffusion. I remember learning about that in chemistry class.
You got it.
Yeah.
And osmosis is a specific type of diffusion where water moves across the membrane to even out the concentration of those solutes. Now, active transport, on the other hand, is like climbing a ladder.
It needs energy.
Exactly. It requires energy, usually coming from ATP.
Interesting. But why would a cell go through all that trouble to move something against its concentration gradient? It seems kind of inefficient.
Great question. Think about glucose again. It's crucial for cells to make energy, but sometimes the concentration of glucose inside the cell is actually higher than outside.
So it already has enough.
You would think so, but the cell still needs more. So it uses these special carrier proteins like GLUT1 to import more glucose.
GLUT1, huh? So those carrier proteins are like tiny little shuttles.
Precisely. They bind to glucose on one side of the membrane, then change shape and release it on the other side. It's all about ensuring a steady supply of glucose for the cell's energy needs. And actually, malfunctions in these glucose transporters are a major factor in diabetes.
Wow, it all comes back to diabetes, huh? That's amazing. I never realized how much was going on at the cellular level.
It's a busy place to be.
It is. But what about moving bigger things like proteins or hormones? They can't just like squeeze through those tiny channels, right?
Nope, you're right. They can't. For those bigger cargoes, cells use something called a vesicular transport. Basically, these substances are packaged into tiny membrane-bound sacs called vesicles. Right. And in endocytosis, the cell membrane engulfs a substance, bringing it inside the cell, kind of like, swallowing. And exocytosis is the opposite. The vesicle fuses with the membrane and releases its contents outside the cell.
So it's like a cellular postal
I
service.
like that. A very efficient one.
That's amazing. But we've been talking a lot about the chemical movements and all that. What about the electrical side of cells? I vaguely remember something about membrane potential.
You're on the right track. Cells actually have an electrical charge across their membranes, and this is vital for nerve impulses, muscle contractions, tons of processes.
Wait, cells are electric? How does that even work?
It comes down to the uneven distribution of these things called ions, or charged particles, across the membrane. You can kind of think of it like a battery. You have that separation of charge that creates this electrical potential difference.
So it's like a tiny electrical circuit inside each cell.
Exactly. And this electrical potential, we call the membrane potential, it exists in all living cells. But nerve and muscle cells, they're special. We call them excitable cells because they can change their membrane potential really rapidly.
Rapidly.
Yeah. And that's how they can transmit signals.
Fascinating. But what determines this membrane potential in the first place?
The movement of potassium ions is a major factor. Cells have a high concentration of potassium inside and a low concentration outside. So these potassium ions tend to leak out of the cell through special channels, and they leave behind negatively charged proteins. That separation of charge, that's what creates the membrane potential.
So at rest, it's usually around, what was it?
Negative 70 millivolts, which means the inside of the cell is more negative than the outside.
Okay, so potassium is like a key player here. But how does this all relate to nerve impulses? You know, how does a signal actually travel down a nerve?
That, my friend, is where action potentials come in, and that's what we'll be exploring next.
This is getting really interesting. I can't wait to learn more about these action potentials. All right, we're back, and I'm ready to tackle those action potentials.
I'm ready when you are.
Great. So action potentials, they're like the language of our nerves, right? Like, can we decode them?
Absolutely. Think of action potentials as, while they're rapid changes in that membrane potential that allow for, you know, communication over long distances in nerve cells. Imagine it like a chain reaction, or maybe a domino effect.
Okay, I like the domino analogy. So how does that actually work, like with those electrical charges in our cells?
Well, imagine each domino is like a small section of the nerve cell membrane. So when a stimulus, anything from a touch to, you know, a sound, anything, it reaches a nerve cell, it causes a change in that section's membrane potential. It's called depolarization. And if this depolarization is strong enough, well, it has to reach a certain threshold, and then boom, it triggers an action potential.
So it's like knocking over that first domino, and then the rest just fall in sequence.
Exactly. And that tipping point, we call it the threshold potential. And once it's reached, a voltage-gated sodium channels in the membrane, they spring open.
Voltage-gated channels.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. Those are like little gates that that open and close, depending on the membrane potential, right?
Right. When that threshold is reached, those sodium channels open up, and sodium ions, well, they just rush into the cell. And remember, sodium is more concentrated outside the cell, so it naturally flows down its concentration gradient. It's like a crowded room where, well, everyone wants to move to where there's more space.
Right. Makes sense. And since sodium ions have a positive charge, they make the inside of the cell less negative. So that's what causes that rapid depolarization. But how does it go back to its resting state? Does it just like stay positive?
No, not at all. That's where potassium comes back in. As the membrane potential becomes more positive, these voltage-gated potassium channels, they open up and potassium ions flow out of the cell.
So potassium is like the reset button.
Yeah, you could say that. This outward flow of potassium ions, it repolarizes the membrane, bringing it back down toward that resting potential. Actually, it oversheats a little bit.
It does.
Yeah, it causes a brief hyperpolarization before it settles back to that resting state.
Okay, so depolarization with sodium and then repolarization with potassium. I think I'm getting it. What about those refractory periods? We talked about those earlier. Where do they fit in?
Oh, great question. The refractory period, that's a short time after an action potential when it's really difficult, sometimes even impossible, to trigger another one. It's like a brief cool down period.
For that section of the membrane.
Right, for that section.
That makes sense. So how does this action potential, this electrical signal, actually travel down the nerve fiber? Mm-hmm. Is it just like zip along like electricity in a wire?
Not quite. Remember that the axon, the long part of the nerve cell, it's not a perfect conductor. There's some resistance and some leakage of current.
So how does it keep its strength over long distances? Wouldn't it weaken?
That's what's so cool. The action potential doesn't just travel as a single wave. It's actually regenerated at each point along the axon. Remember those dominoes?
Yeah.
Each domino knocks over the next one, and that propagates the signal down the line.
So each section of the axon is triggering an action potential in the next section.
Exactly. the influx of those sodium ions during depolarization, well, it spreads to the next region of the membrane, and that brings it to the threshold, triggering a new action potential. And this process, it just continues down the entire length of the axon, so the signal transmits without losing any strength.
Wow, that is incredibly efficient. You mentioned myelination earlier, that the fatty coating around some nerve fibers.
Right.
How does that play into all this?
Good point. Myelin, you can think of it like insulation around an electrical wire. It prevents that leakage of current, allowing the signal to jump from one node of Ranvier to the next.
Nodes of Ranvier. Those are the gaps between the myelin sheaths, right?
Exactly. And this jumping conduction, we call it saltatory conduction, it speeds things up significantly. Think of it like taking an express train instead of a local one.
So myelination is like upgrading the nervous system to high-speed rail.
Precisely. And this is especially important for those long nerves, like the ones that go from your spinal cord all the way down to your toes. Mm. Without myelin, well, those signals would travel a lot slower.
It's amazing how efficient the body is. So we've got the signal speeding down the axon, but how does it actually get passed on to another cell? That's where the synapses come in, right?
You got it. Synapses, they're the junctions between neurons, or even between a neuron and a target cell, like a muscle or a gland. They're like tiny little bridges where the electrical signal is converted into a chemical one.
Okay, break that down for me. How does an electrical signal become chemical?
It's a pretty cool process. So when the action potential reaches the end of the axon, we call that the axon terminal, it triggers the opening of voltage-gated calcium channels.
More voltage-gated channels.
Yep. So these calcium ions flow into the axon terminal, and then that triggers the release of neurotransmitters.
Neurotransmitters. Those are the chemical messengers, right?
Yeah.
Like dopamine and serotonin, all those.
Exactly. They're stored in these tiny little sacs, we call them synaptic vesicles, inside that axon terminal. And when calcium flows in, it causes those vesicles to fuse with the membrane, releasing their contents into the synaptic cleft.
The synaptic cleft, that's that gap between the two cells, right?
Right. So the neurotransmitters just diffuse across that gap and bind to receptors on the receiving cell.
And this binding triggers a response in that postsynaptic cell.
Exactly. It could be another action potential, a muscle contraction, all sorts of things. It just depends on the signal.
So it's like a relay race,
mm-hmm.
with the signal being passed from one neuron to the next or to a target cell. But not all signals are excitatory, right?
Right. Not all signals are the same. They can have excitatory or inhibitory effects on that postsynaptic cell. So excitatory signals, well, they make it more likely for the receiving cell to fire an action potential, but inhibitory signals actually make it less likely.
So it's a balancing act between these opposing signals.
Exactly. And that balance is crucial for regulating all that nerve activity and make sure we have, you know, precise control over our movements, our thoughts, all those bodily functions.
This is mind-blowing. It's incredible how these tiny electrical and chemical signals just orchestrate everything our bodies do.
It really is. And remember, this is just a glimpse into how complex the nervous system is. But understanding those basic principles of action potentials and synaptic transmission, well, it opens up a whole world of understanding how our brains and our bodies actually communicate.
I'm already eager to hear more. What other wonders are in store for us? Welcome back for the final part of our deep dive into, well, the amazing world of human physiology. We've covered a lot of ground, from how our bodies manage to maintain that delicate balance to those lightning-fast action potentials zipping through our nerves.
And now we're going to dive even deeper into the fascinating world of synapses.
Because it's those synapses that really shape everything, don't they? From our thoughts and feelings to our actions.
Absolutely. It all comes down to those connections.
It's mind-blowing when you think about it. All these complex processes are happening constantly, but at like a microscopic level.
It really is remarkable. And remember how we were talking about excitatory and inhibitory signals?
Yeah.
Well, neurons, they don't just receive one signal at a time. They're bombarded with input from, well, tons of other neurons, each carrying its own little message.
So it's like a cellular party where everyone's trying to talk at once.
That's a great way to put it. And that neuron, it has to sort through all of this incoming information and decide what to do next. That's where summation comes in.
Summation. It sounds like some serious calculations are going on inside those tiny neurons.
It's not exactly calculus, but it does involve adding up all those signals, the excitatory and the inhibitory ones. If the excitatory signals, well, if they outweigh the inhibitory ones, and if the overall signal strength reaches that threshold we talked about, then the neuron fires an action potential and passes that message along.
But if the inhibitory signals are stronger,
then the neuron stays quiet.
So it's like this constant tug of war going on between those signals, and that determines whether the neuron will fire or not.
Precisely. And this back and forth, it's happening all the time throughout your entire nervous system, and it allows for, well, incredible control over how your body responds to everything.
Wow. That's fascinating. But are all those signals treated equally? Or are some, like, more important than others?
That's a great question. There are actually two main types of summation, temporal and spatial.
Okay. Temporal and spatial.
Right. So temporal summation, that's like getting a rapid-fire series of texts from the same friend. The more messages they send in a short time, the more likely you are to, you know, notice and respond.
Makes sense.
It's similar in neurons. If a presynaptic neuron sends a bunch of excitatory signals really quickly, one after the other, they add up, and that increases the chances of hitting that threshold and triggering an action potential in the postsynaptic neuron.
So in temporal summation, it's the frequency that really matters.
Exactly. Now, spatial summation, that's more like getting messages from, well, from several friends at the same time. Even if each message is short, their combined effect can get your attention.
Right.
So in neurons, this means that if you have multiple excitatory signals arriving from different presynaptic neurons, even if they aren't firing that rapidly, they can still add up and reach that threshold.
So spatial summation is all about the combined strength of those signals.
Exactly. And don't forget about those inhibitory signals. They're playing a critical role, too. They can dampen those excitatory signals, making it harder to reach the threshold.
So it's this incredibly dynamic dance of signals, with the excitatory and inhibitory inputs always interacting to shape how the neuron responds.
That's a great way to put it. It's this intricate dance happening billions of times across your nervous system that gives rise to, well, the complexity of your thoughts, your feelings, your actions. It's really the foundation of everything that makes you, well, you.
Wow. We started with this idea of the body maintaining balance, and now we've uncovered this incredibly detailed world of signals that influence, well, our entire being.
And this is really just the beginning. There's still so much more to learn about how the nervous system develops and how it adapts and what happens when things go wrong, you know, and disease.
It really makes you appreciate just how much is happening under the surface, all these processes working together to keep our bodies running smoothly.
It really is amazing.
Well, I think our brains are officially full for today. It's been an incredible journey exploring this symphony of signals that orchestrate our lives. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into human physiology. And remember, this is just the start. There's a whole universe of knowledge out there waiting to be discovered.
So keep asking questions and never stop exploring.
Until next time, stay curious.